Attestant number 32394, Mr. Don Farrington, Reel 13. Now, so what happened next? That was May the 8th, the news of the day. The war's over in Europe, but you've got to get home still, haven't you? And there's still a bit of story before you get home.
Yeah, well, I can't remember what that was now. I need a bit of assistance.
Oh, just so you leave on May the 11th.
Yeah.
And what do you remember about the journey back? In the Dakotas. You fly to Brussels, don't you?
Well, that's right. Well, they took us by transport, first of all, to what was it called? The airfield?
Hildesheim.
Hildesheim, yes. That's where we were taken by the trucks, first of all. And then we got the Dakota from there, and we went to Brussels. Right.
Anything about the flights in Dakota?
No, not really. We were just so overjoyed to be thinking we're getting nearer and nearer to getting home. I think we'd only got one thing in mind at that time, the fact we were free for the first time.
So you flew to Brussels. Eventually you leave on the 13th. There's a bit of a wait at the airfield, and you go to Brussels on the 13th of May.
Yeah.
And then what?
Well, we were then told we would have a couple of days, I think, in Brussels, and then we were waiting for us to get a call to go to the airport for transport back to England.
And that's, again, that's on May the 14th, so you're basically going to Dakota.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Now, what do you remember about when you got back? I mean, what was your reception? You got to Cosford.
I think everybody kissed the ground.
Really? I mean, really did it?
Oh, yes. Oh, very emotional there. Very emotional. I think the thing I remember best about the flight, though, going back to England, the bloke, because he knew we weren't all Air Force people, the bloke that came in to me said, "Do you want to go sit with the pilot?" Oh, I said, "Yeah." I think to see the White Cliffs of Dover, God dear, I can still cry about that now.
I think
it was a wonderful emotion, actually.
So what happens then? You go on leave?
Well, then I have to go for a complete medical when we landed wherever it was.
Gosford,
that's right. Yes, they were waiting for everybody that had been ex-POW to go in a huge place set up specially for the medication and the checking of the medical situation of each individual, and notes were taken about all kinds of things, and then eventually you were...
And what was your medical state?
Well, it wasn't too bad. I think nerves were the when I was doing this, like, and if you're nervous, these will go. You got to hold them out still like that. And he said, "Well, that's not so bad." That so I passed that, and I must have passed all the other things as well. I had nothing to go back about medical wise at all. So I was quite satisfied with that.
And were you very thin? Had you lost a lot of weight? Or do you not remember?
I honestly don't remember.
What about you?
I must have lost weight, definitely, but I can't remember what the weight was when I got there and they put me on the scales at all.
Now, what about leave?
Well, once I got the... Don't forget, I had to be issued with the Air Force equipment again, my uniform.
What do you remember about that?
Uniform. That was quite interesting, because being commissioned, like, or having a non-commissioned rank, you'd have your badges, all your badges having to go on that you had. Once all that was done, we were sent to... where did we send us to? Is it Hednesford? Rings a bell.
Well, didn't you go on leave first?
Yeah, I think I was given leave. I don't know how much leave I was given then.
Did you enjoy your leave? What was it like being back? I mean, could you settle in?
Well, like was being back, it was like a fairy tale. It was a question you couldn't really take it all in. it had all happened so suddenly. You've been looking forward to that time for years, and or at least it seemed years, and you think that at last, like I said in my the diary, I looked at this. I got off the train, that I had a train from whether, I don't think it was Gosford we were at, I can't remember now.
Doesn't matter.
That getting off the train and at Edgeley, my local station, and walking all the way from there to my, where I lived in Chapel Street as it was then in Stockport, and I had a kit bag on my shoulder full of equipment, and I've got something else that I'd got in my hand as well to carry, and I never thought of getting a taxi. And no money, I don't think, anyway. But I didn't get a taxi. I walked from there with this kit bag on my shoulder all the way down Grenville Street, right the way to where Chapel Street was. And I could see this figure. He said, there. I should see this figure in the distance. She knew I was coming. Mother, I knew I was home then. But,
were you able to settle down on leave? I mean, you know, because sometimes prisoners have trouble. You know.
I don't think so. I don't think I had any trouble. I don't think I had any trouble. I got so many people to see and somebody to talk to.
Now, what about... I don't want to upset you, so let's not think about that too much. So I can tell what you're saying. Yeah. Now, what about... did you go to a rehabilitation centre before you were demobilised? Or were you just demobilised?
No, we went. The only thing we went to another rehabilitation centre, I'm not sure. But the only thing I can remember, the next thing was to go and get my demob suit.
Now, when was that, roughly? Doesn't say in there. Doesn't cover it.
Oh, must be in the other one. Just have a quick look.
Now, you can't remember. Was it in 45 or 46?
What was this?
Your demob.
I'll tell you. Effective date of release was the 27th of February 1946.
Now, what was the demob process? What do you remember about being demobbed? Anything special about it?
Well, that's very vague now what went on. I know I had to have, I had a full medical, obviously, and from one reason or another, I must have got a. I don't know what it says on here, whether it's a health-wise, I think it does, actually.
Don't worry about it. So, did you get a demob suit?
Oh, yes. I had to go to, I'm sure it was called Hednesford, the place.
And what was the suit like?
Well, at that stage in the for civilians then, it was very basic. It was all right, there's nothing wrong with it, but they insisted I take a hat. I never wear hats, or I didn't for a while, and it was a trilby.
Now, what we do now is get you back into to civilian life. So what happened when you got out? I mean, what were you going to go back to your old job? Tell me what you do.
Yeah, well, the first thing to do is to settle down, then go and see where you were previously employed and tell them that you were back and ready and willing and able to start. I don't quite know, because I had quite a bit of official leave still outstanding with the Air Force until the date of release. So I got that time on me to go round to tell the people at the co-op where I was previously employed as a junior clerk, really, because I was only 19 when I left, actually. I had a word with all my friends there, and they were delighted, and I said, well, so we just fixed up a date, and that was it.
So were you back as a wages clerk, or what were you back as? At the Stockport Court.
I was called a wages clerk because I was more of a senior then, although I had still to learn a lot about pay as you earn and things like that, not having been involved with it for a long time.
Now, Was that your career? Did you stay with the Stockport Cooperative Society?
No, I moved on actually. Eventually, as I say, it was a good job at the co-op, but I had a chance of going as an upgraded wages clerk to the electricity board, as it then was. They were advertising for senior wages clerks in the in their establishment. It was at Hazel Grove, which had a depot at Stockport, all to do with the electricity board, which was then in being actually.
And that was your career?
No, it didn't finish there. So I did very well there, especially on wages point of view. I got quite delighted with that. I enjoyed it. But then the time came when, as usual due to politics, the electricity board was having to cut back on the amount of staff it was using. And so my job was one of those that was going to be affected. And what they had to do, they gave you an option that because you were living in Stockport, their main employees in future will be based at Oldham. You could still hold your position if you move to Oldham. But if you don't want to do that, you will have to release you. So I thought, well, I'm not going to travel backwards and forward to Oldham unless I can. So in the meantime, while I was getting some more information about jobs appearing, there was one appeared in the local paper for a similar job in the wages depot of the corporation, Stockport Corporation, in the town hall. So I went for an interview for that and got that job. And now that set me off on my definite career, which I became a senior clerk on wages and superannuation in the town hall. We were then, in actual fact, it wasn't in the salary and wages section in the town hall. It was in the health department, still part of the corporation, but it was in the health department as a senior clerk. So I got that job, and that was fine. Until they had a complete reorganisation.
Well, that gives us the idea anyway. Yeah. That's back it. Into civilian life.
That's now, it, yeah.
Did you have any trouble with acclimatising, mentally or physically, after your RAF and prisoner of war experiences? Because you'd had a rough time. I mean, you'd been shot down. You'd had a terrible time, and then you'd had a terrible time as a prisoner of war. Yeah. Did that affect you, do you think, mentally or physical?
No. I don't know why. I don't know why I didn't get something to disturb my health when I was in the POW camp, when we had that long march, and things were desperate, and people were going down with dysentery and bad feet and all. I just don't understand it.
So your health stood up to it.
Yes.
And no nightmares, no troubles, no traumas.
Oh, I did have a few. I wouldn't say nightmares, but I always had a few initially, all about aircraft. Flying, I can remember them quite vividly, but not scary ones, not ones where I was crashing, funnily enough. It was just flying generally.
Now, what about contacts with your old comrades? Did you join any associations?
Well, the first thing I did when I got back was obviously more to do with domestic things, which was, first of all, I was engaged, then I got married, and then that was the time when I had to seriously think. I got a gratuity from the Air Force, which was then operable after so many years in the Air Force. And that was a large sum of money, about £800, I think it was, at the time, which was, to me, was a lot of money. I was getting married, and we decided that this £800 would be a lifesaver. It would be enough for me to put that down virtually for a mortgage for a house. So we looked for the house, we got the house we wanted, and so basically it starts, as I say, the after effects of the war gradually slowly went, and it was replaced by domesticity.
Now, what about the... did you join any association?
Oh, yes, I joined, but not initially. As I say, my first...
No, I understand that. But when did you, then?
Well, I think most of it started in 1985, when I retired from work. And in 1985, I had been doing a lot of research, started this... on the things that I could still remember quite vividly, and I thought, well, I'll put it all down while I can, while it's fresh, and I can do something about it. So I did that. As I was doing that, I thought, wouldn't it be nice to go back to France, where I'd all had to help with the resistance, and see if I could make contact with them. And you see, I could, and I got through the Escaping Society help. And they said, well, if you want to get in touch with the leader of the resistance at that time, she's still in France. I said, well, if you can give me the address. So all that came about, that I was able to contact her again, and we set up, and I got all the names and the villages where these people lived. And she was able to do all that for me. She contacted each one, and we had a wonderful time. They got together, we had a tremendous reunion, my wife Margaret came with me, and she had a marvellous time. And I think that was a tremendous thing which we did. And I also, at the same time that was happening, joined the Aircrew Association, which also had another association, a POW Association. So I joined the Aircrew Association. I joined the Prisoner of War Association.
Okay, now, what do they do? How valuable are they to you?
Well, one of them's now out of existence.
Is that the POW?
The POW one now has gone long since. But the ACA, I'm in the ACA, and we're on our last legs now. We had a meeting this Christmas, and I think it might be the last one we'll have due to the lack of members now. As you can imagine, we're all in our 80s, or most of us are. And I just think that... it did help. Joining the Aircrew Association was, I can just give you one point why it was so helpful. I got to a point where I didn't know anything about the Aircrew Association apart from what it was supposed to do, get people together for who've been in aircrew. I went to the first meeting on my own, didn't know anybody at all. And when I introduced myself to the secretary, he said, well, what I'm going to do, which I do with all new members, he said, I introduce you, and I want you to introduce yourself, very basically, about what you did, where you were, and all the rest of it, you see, without going into too much detail. So I said, oh, that's all right. So we get to the part where I'm telling what squadron I was on, where it was, and all about what I flew in, and different aircraft, and... then I said, oh, and by the way, I was a POW. And as soon as I mentioned POW, the hands shot up. And there was about four or five of them all sat together. And they'd all been ex-POWs. And would you believe it? One of them particularly had been there in the same camp. And then another one had been in the same camp. And this other one was Albert, and he's still living. He'd been in the same camp, and you remember when I told you the story about the letters all coming at once? He said, it's in my diary. He said, that bloody bloke has got 12 letters just for himself. He said, I haven't got any. That was one of the chaps who I'm still friendly with and still living. That's all. But
another thing is contacting your old crew. I believe you had some success.
Oh yes, yes. I've had success with everything. I am now the only living survivor of the crew. Six of us got out. Three got back to England, and the other three were POWs. I've been in touch eventually with the 90 Squadron, who eventually put me in touch with the other members of the crew, which were still living. And we all met up at a place in somewhere near Newmarket, it was.
What was that like?
Well, that was quite something, yeah. You can imagine, can't you?
Had you all changed? I mean, when did you meet up? Was it in the 80s?
Well, one of them that I met up with had been escaped. You see, of the crew, you've got, apart from the pilot who died, you've got a navigator who was an officer. You've got an engineer who was an NCO. You've got a bomb aimer, an NCO. A wireless operator, an NCO. And you've got a gunner. So you've got those five. And there's another one, isn't there? I missed out somewhere. We had two gunners. That's right, two gunners. Let's take each one at a time, and then I can tell you a bit about. Here we are. We'll take the navigator first of all, Yarwood. Now he lived in London somewhere, and officially he was part of the section that looked after the royal family, he was an officer. Then we go to the bomb aimer, who was a Canadian. I'll just go back to Yarwood. Yarwood was one who got back to England successfully, so he wasn't a prisoner of war. And he was joined by Bulmer. Now, he was a rear gunner, and he must have linked up with Yarwood, and they both got back to England. So that was the two that got. I think there was another one, actually. Oh, yes, and the other one that got back was the other, a mid-upper gunner, called Buchanan. He got back to England on his own, and that was a story on it. So that really was a good story as well. So that left me, the wireless operator, Hofberg, the bomb aimer, and the flight engineer. We were the three prisoners of war. And I got in touch with Harry Yarwood. He was living in America. I got in touch with Murray Hofberg, who was a Canadian. I got in touch with him. I got in touch with Joe Cashmore, who was the engineer, and he did live in the Birmingham area. And Buchanan, the mid-upper gunner, he was an Australian. And Bulmer, he lived in Yorkshire. So I've been in touch with each and every one, but each and every one, unfortunately, now has passed on.
Now, and the final thing, and I don't want to upset you, but I noticed on the front of the latest version of your memoirs, you've got a picture from the cemetery where the pilots the French was.
Yeah, I've got some other.
You actually went to see his grave, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Just say a bit about how important, and I don't want to upset you, but how important French was to you?
I think this is the point with this. This business is another story on its own, with part of it is in here. Is in the meeting up for the first time with all these people that had helped me. That was the most emotional time I can ever remember, because it was the gratitude that they showed, and it was me that was showing the gratitude for what they'd done for me. But they were absolutely, they couldn't do enough for me. And my wife said she couldn't get over it. How good they were, and how delighted they were to see. And I said, "Well, that's it." I said, "He looked after me like a son." I said, "But however, it's no, it's just one of those things. It's a very emotional time because it takes people back a good few years, and it, don't forget it was 1985, so it's nearly 40 years, you see, isn't it, since I was in there, just over 40 years since I was in the Air Force, and consequently, as I say, a lot of people, probably because it was so long after the war had finished, sort of 1945 when it finished, so it was virtually 40 years since I really did anything really record it.
Now tell me, the final thing, you made a plaque for French, didn't you? Yeah. Put it on Instagram. Tell me about that, because a little ceremony. And
it's in here somewhere. Yes, well, what happened to the plaque? I don't know if I have a photograph I can show you afterwards, but this plaque was made by on my institution as a commemoration to Frank French, the fact that the crew owed our lives to him because of the way he handled the aircraft at the time that the, we were hit. He gave us enough time, fortunately, to all get out successfully, that's six of us. And by the time we got the sixth out, he was too low to get out himself. And he went in trying to crash land it, but he would explode because we got ammunition and everything on board. So it would be a quick ending, fortunately. But he was only 21. I was 1944, I was 23, wasn't I? Yeah, 23. And the navigator, the officer navigator, he was 33. We called him Granddad.
So you still feel you still feel a debt to Frank French?
Oh yes, I mean no question. I've got a big painting in the other room of the one of our 90 squadron members was an amateur artist, and he'd done some fine paintings. So I said, would you do one of mine? So you can see it afterwards. And they said that describes how low we were when we were actually hit. So he gained height just initially to about 1,000 feet and no more. And from then, they started evacuating or going off one after the other in turn, until eventually, by the time the sixth one had got out, he was too low to get out himself. And that's why this business was always done. I was determined to get this plaque done to put on his grave. And the second part was to find out where his grave was. Well, I found out all about that when we had our first reunion. She took me, and she told, and this lady would only be about 12 years old when this actually happened. And she actually saw the plane with her mother and father coming down, and just watched it coming down and hit the ground, and that was it. But they were able eventually to get hold of the body. The Germans wouldn't let them anywhere near it until later on, and then they and all the villagers round, all that village round, all got together to give him a proper burial, and then we were able to go and and see it and do what we said we'd do, look after it. So we've been several times since then. And I've had a wonderful, wonderful time.
Thank you very much.